union. Now the lessons of the
past were Welcome to Madison Labor Radio. Labor Radio is dedicated to bringing news, information, and cultural events focused on working people and the labor movement to the Madison area, surrounding communities. I'm Jimmy Coonan, member of Carpenters and Joiners Local 314. Your support is necessary to make Labor Radio and all the great programming on WART possible.
Hiya, I'm Madison Delier, an East High Schooler. Today we discuss issues and threats to Social Security. Hear about a rally by Madison teachers held this week. Join the League of Women Voters to take a look at the amendments on the up-and-coming ballot, and much more.
Teachers and staff of Madison Public Schools and community supporters rallied at a meeting of the city's school board this week. Greg Jabowski reports.
Hey, hey, ho, ho, 0.0 has got to go.
Hey, hey, ho, ho, 0.0 has got to go. Hey, hey.
On Monday evening, hundreds of Madison School District teachers, staff, and labor and community supporters rallied and marched at the Doyle Administration Building on West Dayton Street ahead of a regularly scheduled 6 p.m. meeting of the Madison School Board. The action was organized by Madison Teachers Incorporated, or MTI, the teachers union representing Madison teachers and school staff. 0.0% is what the board is currently offering teachers as a cost of living adjustment, meaning it is an effective pay cut with inflation. MTI is asking for a 4.12% cost of living adjustment, the small amount authorized for bargaining under Wisconsin's Act 10. Michael Jones, president of the teachers unit of MTI, explained why the rally was called.
We are strongly advocating for the schools our students deserve and our families and our staff also deserve in terms of really improving allocation. That's staffing at all levels in all schools because our kids need more staff, especially around mental health support.
Katie Bordona, an English as a second language teacher at La Follette High and an MTI union rep there, spoke of two key demands, the COLA and adequate staffing.
Obviously, one of the concerns that we're bringing up tonight is the 0.0% COLA. It has a huge impact on worker morale, hearing that that's the value that they place on our work. I think another thing is that we are in a teaching shortage crisis. For the students, that's like a huge issue. Obviously, it's an issue for staff as well, but if there aren't enough people in the building educating our children, that has horribly negative effects.
The rally featured the voices of not only regular teachers, but representatives of the many other staffers who keep schools running, such as school nurses and professional service specialists. David O'Keefe is a substitute teacher at Sandberg Elementary, who bargains with the United Substitute Organization of MPI, described what substitutes see of overall district staffing shortages.
All teachers are on the front line of our education crisis, and substitutes, just like any other teaching profession, have a slightly different view of it. And, you know, we're kind of just expected to come in and fill a lot of these gaps that most of the time, you know, we're not coming in to fill a gap that just got created. Probably there's been a gap in the school for months, and they probably covered it with another teacher because every school has more than 10 shortages per day.
Others from organized labor were there in solidarity. Here's Evan McKenzie, an organizer at OPEIU Local 39, who recently was a shift supervisor at the Main Street Starbucks store where he helped organize a union with Starbucks Workers United.
I think that every union in the city has a need to stick together. I think Madison is the perfect place to do it. We're all tight on this isthmus, and we all have a lot of the same problems. You know, I love seeing all the different people out here at this rally. It's really, really inspiring.
The crowd gathered in the Doyle Building parking lot, marched around the building, and rallied, with a loading dock serving as a speaker's platform. Elizabeth O'Leary, a fourth grade teacher at Hawthorne Elementary, emceed the rally and had this to say.
When the workers come together and decide they've had enough, that is when real change happens, right? Yes. When we come together and stand together, that's when change happens. So each time you fill out an attendance sheet, that helps your union leaders organize better.
The group would crowd into the Doyle Building, presenting a petition to the board, and pack in the administration building auditorium, where teachers and staff spoke to the school board long into the night, but not before leaving the loading dock with this chant.
This is a repeat after me song. We are the union!
We are the union!
The mighty, mighty union!
The mighty, mighty union!
For Labor Radio, I'm Greg Jabowski.
Union and retired union leaders are sounding the alarm about current threats to Social Security. Labor Radio spoke with Jessica LaPointe, president of the American Federation of Government Employees, or AFGE, Council 220, and Alex Brewer, the executive director of the Wisconsin Alliance for Retired Americans, an organization advocating for retired union employees.
There are three primary threats to Social Security looming, according to Jessica LaPointe and Alex Brewer. The first threat has to do with the underfunding of the agency itself, resulting in understaffing, ancient computer systems, delays in responses to the public, and a burgeoning caseload that current staff cannot manage.
The union that represents the workers and the commissioner that oversees the head of the agency has determined that Social Security is in crisis, that we are no longer providing timely access to services and benefits to Wisconsinites and to beneficiaries nationwide, or really the millions of people that come seeking questions about our benefits. We cannot get to the customers timely. Over the last decade, we've seen an influx of applicants to the tune of 25%. And the reason why benefits and services aren't timely is because there has been a 20% decrease in our operating budget, and Congress decides our operating budget. Right now, we have baby boomers retiring at a rate of 12,000 a week. They knew that was coming, and they decided to limit Social Security's access to the trust funds to be able to handle the increased workloads.
What's the solution?
We're just asking that Congress loosens the purse strings of the trust funds and let us operate at about 1.2%, but they've been very reluctant to do that, and they haven't said why. They are creating a fictitious narrative that somehow Social Security adds to the national deficit, and it doesn't. Social Security is a self-funded program.
The second threat to Social Security is the solvency of the fund itself.
We have a growing number of retirees in the United States, and because of that, the Social Security Trust Fund is projected to not be able to meet all of the demands on payments out. The most recent projection I heard is that Social Security will only be able to pay out 80% of benefits by 2034.
How could this be resolved?
One of the things that we're pushing is for Social Security to eliminate something called the contribution and benefits base. Basically, there's a cap on the payroll taxes that you can pay into Social Security. So anybody who makes over the course of a single year more than $168,800 stops paying into Social Security. That's called the contribution and benefits base, that cap. We're calling for that to be eliminated. Anybody making any amount will pay their portion of Social Security. Additional money is going to come into the Social Security Trust Fund and make that program solvent.
We can fix the benefit solvency through legislation like the 2100 Act that Congressman Larson put forward, or the Sanders and Warren Social Security Expansion Act that will deal with lifting the earnings cap so that millionaires and billionaires are paying their fair share into the program.
The third and final threat to Social Security is a bill currently in the House.
There is a bill called the Fiscal Commission that is threatening to potentially raise the retirement age so that seniors have to work into their 70s or even potentially 80s before they can start to collect Social Security.
There are midday rallies taking place throughout the state in April and May. For more information, go to wisconsin.retiredamericans.org. That was Alex Brewer and Jessica LaPointe. This is Janine Ramsey reporting for Madison Labor Radio.
Well, the
tell you this, there'll be no 70 or 80 year old workers. Workers facing a long union busting effort at an Apple store in Chicago found things escalating when workers stood up for Palestinians. Greg Jabowski has more.
A year and a half long union organizing drive at an Apple retail store in Chicago has reached a head over solidarity with Palestinians facing an ongoing Israeli assault in the Gaza Strip, with workers fired and concerted activity suppressed, according to workers there. Labor Radio spoke Wednesday to Andres Guzman, who was until last week an employee at the Apple store in Chicago's Lincoln Park neighborhood. Guzman described the start of the organizing effort.
I started organizing a union on May 2022. This was around the time where the first Apple store were signing authorization cards back in April. It was New York Grand Central. And when this made news, a lot of us were talking about the possibility of forming a union in the workplace. Next thing you know, we hear that Atlanta also filed to have a union election. So I started organizing because a friend of mine in a different store, he asked me, hey, do you want to go to this union training? And I said, yes. And I was the only person representing my store. After that whole union training, I felt like, you know, maybe I should do this. So I contacted one person that I knew, and it was basically his. We founded the organizing committee. We got a list of people we had to talk to and just started making assessments.
Guzman described how Apple's response to the organizing drive played out at his workplace.
Apple's national response is they invest in this anti-union law firm called Littler Mendelsohn. It's the same one that Starbucks is using. In my store specifically, we had a store meeting on December 2022. After that store meeting, basically anyone who spoke up at that store meeting, because we were talking about a lot of issues in the workplace, such as hours, benefits, trade-in policies, resale policies, and we were asking a lot of questions that they weren't able to answer. After that meeting, people just started getting terminated. And a lot of us perceived that as Apple's first shot at people who speak out on working conditions. After that happened, we basically had a lot of black and brown employees being terminated from then until now, including me.
Then came October 7th.
We went through a lot the last 2 years, but I'd say things definitely escalated after October 7th. I already knew where I stood. I knew I stood for Palestine. I knew I stood for human rights. And I was going to be quiet about it. I did not want to say anything. I was just going to keep my thoughts to myself. On October 9th, Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, decided to send a company-wide email titled Israel. He took a political stance by saying Israel in the subject line, and he basically said that he was, you know, mourning the loss of innocent civilian lives. And in that email, he didn't make any mention of Palestine or Palestinians. That right there was what unsettled a lot of workers, not only in my store, but throughout the company.
Guzman says that worker support for Palestinian solidarity brought a quick negative response from Apple management.
It basically triggered my entire store because we do have two Palestinian workers at my store that no longer work there anymore. One of them was fired after months of harassment for wearing her kufiya. She was told to take off her kufiya. Then she was told to take off her kufiya headband. Then she was told to take off her Tatri's armband. Then she was told she couldn't have a Palestinian flag in the workplace when they literally had Latin American flags in the workplace hanging in the break room at the moment. They told her to take off her Free Palestine wristbands. It was like nobody was allowed to utter the word Palestine or say the word Palestinian. Because just like when you say that you're pro-union and you're at risk for being disciplined on a misconduct or terminated, now it's if you say the words Palestine or, you know, you say that you support the Palestinians, again, you're at risk for termination, misconduct, documented coaching, and any disciplinary measures.
The worker mentioned by Guzman was Madley Espinoza, a Palestinian who was fired by the store. The worker and community response to Espinoza's firing was widespread and immediate, says Guzman.
They were upset when Madley was terminated. They were upset because they knew that Madley was a good worker and they knew everything that Madley was going through. When Madley was terminated, the community spoke out, literally, like she was terminated. 5 hours later, all of a sudden, there were 20 protesters saying Free Palestine outside of the Apple store and were calling them out for the wrongful termination of my colleague. And ever since then, the protesters came back for another one. And then the more recent protest that happened was on April 6th, where they blockaded the street, and even though the store had to shut down.
At the time of the April 6th protest, Guzman had been under Apple's documented coaching disciplinary procedure, a procedure which Guzman believes is one of the many pretextual methods used by Apple to target union organizers. Guzman was at work and joined the rally, which he feels led to his firing, although other causes would be cited.
The date that I was fired was on April 11th, 2024. I was placed on a documented coaching on January, it was either 27th or 28th. When the April 6th protest happened, I was working during that time. And at some point, you know, me and my coworker, we both decided to just walk. We both engaged in concerted activity. And I left a message on my work communications channel to raise group complaints about issues that are deeply and widely felt in the workplace, such as racism, sexual harassment, union busting, retaliation. And when I walked out, I joined the protest and I actually spoke out at the protest and I made a speech.
That was Andres Guzman, a recently fired Chicago Apple Store employee and a union organizer there. Guzman has worked with Apple's For Ceasefire, which has an open letter to Apple CEO Cook expressing shock at the company's lack of support for Palestinian lives. Guzman encourages present or former Apple employees to sign the letter at applesforceasefire.com. That's APPLES, the number 4, ceasefire.com for Labor Radio. I'm Greg Jaboski.
UW campuses are closing, but new legislation can assist branch campuses with new grants.
The University of Wisconsin has 13 branch campuses educating students in the current school year. However, declining enrollment has prompted campus closures at 4 campuses, Waukesha, Washington County, Fond du Lac, and Marinette. The UW-Platteville Baraboo-Sauk County campus has the lowest enrollment at 210 students. However, it is also one of 3 branch campuses that has increased enrollment this academic year. Branch campuses have smaller student bodies and lower tuition than the 13 main campuses that grant higher-level degrees. The Baraboo-Sauk County campus is unique in another way. It is the only branch campus that is jointly owned by the university and the local government. This could make it possible to keep the 2-year campus open. This week, the Sauk County Board approved by 28-1 funding of $390,000 in each of 2 years to cover maintenance costs at the campus. This could be the start of a financial turnaround for that campus. Sauk County Board Supervisor Brian Pepper said, "It is in our interest in Sauk County to help our youth out who can't afford maybe to travel to Platteville or Madison or Eau Claire." Another tool for these campuses is a GOP-authored bill signed by the governor that grants up to $2 million per campus for redevelopment. This bill requires the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation to award grants for costs associated with the redevelopment of buildings or other jointly owned sites on a UW system branch campus. Sources for this story are the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, the Wisconsin State Journal, and the Legislative Reference Bureau. Reporting for Labor Radio, this is Carol Weidel.
After over a century of operation as a local chain, Metcalf's Market will soon be under out-of-state ownership. Labor Radio considers the implications of this recent sale for the store's customers and workers.
Local grocer Metcalf's will soon be acquired by Spartan Nash, a Michigan-based food supplier and owner of nearly 144 grocery stores across the globe. Metcalf's has been locally operated in Wisconsin since 1917, when the first store was opened in the Butler suburb of Milwaukee. The store gradually expanded, opening another location in 1969 and 2 more in 2003 and 2013. The deal was announced on Monday and includes the store's 3 current brick-and-mortar markets across Madison and Wauwatosa, as well as a food kiosk at Dane County Regional Airport. Spartan Nash claimed in a public statement that the store's existing locations will maintain their branding and current staff will remain employed, though whether the compensation for their work would materially change was not made clear. The company also announced plans to expand the number of locations to 7 once the deal is officially closed. Public information about mergers and acquisitions are usually included in a company's quarterly filings with the SEC. Since the acquisition has not yet been made official, further information about the terms of the deal have not been disclosed. Local 1473 of the United Food and Commercial Workers, which represents workers at the Wauwatosa and Midvale locations, did not immediately return Labor Radio's request for comment, though it will no doubt have a material interest in the final terms of the sale. Customers were also promised continuity in the, quote, core shopper experience offered in the store. Before the sale, Metcalf's supply model relied heavily on the sale of locally sourced or otherwise certified organic foods, which raises questions about whether Spartan Nash's claims of continuity will extend to stocking the store's shelves. Shareholders in the company, for example, raised concerns this week about the company's transparency around their pork suppliers, specifically whether or not those suppliers use containment units that are so tight that they prevent pigs from, quote, turning around for months or weeks at a time, according to an SEC filing reviewed by Labor Radio. Such animal cruelty, according to the document, could pose, quote, serious material risks to the company. Reporting for Labor Radio, this is Sean Hagerup.
The League of Women Voters of Wisconsin has worked to inform voters about the constitutional amendment proposals that have been on our ballots recently, and that will continue to be on our ballots in coming elections. Labor Radio spoke to Sue Jenick, the program director of Dane County League and chair of Legislative Committee for the Wisconsin League, about these amendments and their potential impact on the people of Wisconsin.
The constitutional amendments that were on the ballot passed. Can you give us a quick overview of that?
There were two questions on the ballot. Question one had to do with prohibiting the use of any private donations for election administration, and that passed by 54%. Question two limited anyone performing tasks in the conduct of an election to election officials, and that passed by 58%. In both cases, the turnout statewide was 25%. So that means 13 and 14% of the electorate approved a change to the Constitution, which goes into effect immediately. And it just is not a democratic way to change our governing document.
What about Dane County?
Dane County had a higher turnout of 35%. And had a no vote of 69%. I think we in the League can take some credit for that. There were other organizations working to educate people about the effect of a yes vote and how damaging it would be for our elections in the future.
Can you give us an overview of the constitutional amendment process?
The state legislature has to pass proposed amendments in two consecutive legislative sessions. These were both passed in the previous legislative session, and then they were passed again this year. After that, then the legislature decides when it will go on the ballot and what the ballot language will be.
Why are we seeing so many constitutional amendments?
There are some people who are concerned that the governor doesn't agree with them and has vetoed many of the proposals that they had made. And so they're doing an end run around the governor and also our state Supreme Court. What's really unfortunate, though, is that these important amendments to our Constitution are presented in primary elections, which traditionally have a low turnout. It's not fair to say a majority of the people in this state approved those amendments because it was actually a very small minority that approved them.
What are we going to see coming forward?
Unfortunately, the August 13th ballot, which is another primary election with traditionally low turnout, will have two more proposed amendments to the Constitution. And they have to do with allocating federal funds. Basically, they're saying only the legislature may determine how monies are appropriated, and specifically, the governor may not allocate federal funds unless the legislature approves. That is particularly problematic when you look at a year like this one. This year, the legislature adjourned on March 12th. They don't plan to meet for the rest of the year. They're done. And Wisconsin has been allocated $2.5 billion in direct state aid, and that's under the American Rescue Plan. That money is available. but it must be allocated by December 31st, 2024. If this constitutional amendment were to pass and the money would not be allocated by the legislature, it would be lost.
What can people do?
The number one thing we need to do is encourage people to vote. And then we have to educate them about the existence of these amendments and why the League is opposing them.
That was Sue Jenick. This is Janine Ramsey reporting for Madison Labor Radio.
And now, an event announcement from AskMe Local 1.
Hello, my name is Warren, and I'm a State of Wisconsin employee, and I'm also a member of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, Local 1, also known as the Wisconsin State Employees Union. On Tuesday, April 30th at 5:30 p.m., Local 1 will be hosting a meet and greet at the Madison Public Library Central location at 201 West Mifflin Street, room 104. Just off of Capitol Square. We will have donuts, water, and other refreshments, including gluten-free refreshments. We want to connect with as many state employees as possible to better understand what state service is like across departments, job titles, designations, classifications, etc. We're focusing on the issue of staffing. The latest information we have from the state shows a high vacancy rate at the state agencies. And we've heard from many of our coworkers and from our members about how they're feeling the strain and how they're becoming burned out from being asked to do more with fewer coworkers. The event will be casual. We will have members of AFSCME Local 1, the Wisconsin State Employees Union, and the Wisconsin Professional Employees Council, represented by the American Federation of Teachers, available to listen to our coworkers' concerns. And we'll also have a presentation on the organizing we've been undertaking in the past year or so and upcoming events and goals. If folks want more information, they can reach us on Facebook. Just look up AFSCME Local 1 or the Wisconsin State Employees Union. Again, the event is 5:30 p.m. on April 30th at the Madison Public Library Central Branch at 201 West Mifflin Street, room 104. We look forward to seeing you there if you're one of our colleagues. And if you're not, but you know a state worker, please forward them the information and encourage them to attend. We would love to see them there.
Workers' Memorial Day takes place annually around the world on April 28th. It is an international day of remembrance and action for workers killed, disabled, injured, or made unwell by their work. April 28th is the anniversary of the Occupational Safety and Health Act of 1970 going into effect and when the Occupational Safety and Health Administration was formed in 1971. On Thursday, April 25th at 10:20 a.m. at the Madison Labor Temple, a Workers' Memorial Day commemoration and press conference will mark the occasion. Union supporters are encouraged to wear their union or work attire. Again, the memorial will be held on Thursday at 10:30 a.m. at the Madison Labor Temple, 1602 South Park Street in Madison.
Thanks to our editor Frank M. Spack, assistant Robin G., copy editor Simon Gordon, reporters Greg Jabowski, Carol Weidel, Sean Hingerup, Janine Ramsey, Bryant Novakowski, and damage control specialist Joanne Powers. Special thanks to Keith Steffens, our reader coordinator, engagement editor Alice Herman, and to all the readers and members of the IBEW Local 2304 WORT Staff Collective. And this is Jimmy Coonan saying goodbye.
And I'm Madison Delier. We would also like to thank all the generous contributors to Labor Radio and WRT. Please stay tuned for Blues Cruise with Dave Watts and the professor, Bill Clark.
Record Store Day is on Saturday, April 20th, and you're invited to celebrate the biggest day in records with WORT DJs.
At the door, 4509 Monona Drive, Matt and Mike from the Mosh Pit will be spinning Heaviness from 1 to 3 p.m.
And at Sig's Treasure Chest and Paradox Vintage Parking Lot Market, 222 North Street, you can catch
Steph Stringer from Her Infinite Variety at noon,
DJ Kiara Skyro from Fuzzy Lifting Drink at 1 p.m.,
DJ Spin Cycle from Pan Africa at 2,
Ms. Nikki from Soul Sessions and Her Infinite Variety at 3,
and Bad Sister Heidi from Psychoacoustics at 4.
And if that's not enough for you, WORT is hosting a 420 Record Store Day after party at the Crystal Corner.
Saturday, April 20th is Record Store Day, and it's exploding with WORT DJ goodness in Monona at the Door and in Madison at the Sigs and Paradox parking lot market.
You are listening to WORT Madison.
The High Noon Saloon presents Natty Nation's 420 Reggae Party on Saturday, April 20th at 7 p.m. Natty Nation blends authentic reggae with elements of rock, soul, and funk to create a unique Midwestern sound. Natty are joined by the 13-piece reggae sensation Dub Foundation and the jazzy reggae of polyrhythmic roots, along with your host, DJ Trichrome. More information can be found at high-noon.com. The High Noon Saloon presents Natty Nation's annual 420 Reggae Party with special guests Dub Foundation and Polyrhythmic Roots, and hosted by DJ Trichrome on Saturday, April 20th.